This is the obstacles to access panel discussion, in case you were wondering. So if you were planning to be somewhere else, you're in the wrong place, but we're glad you're here. We happy few. I'm Tim Wheeler, a reporter with this workshop, which I hope is really more of just a roundtable discussion in the end, and involves everybody here, is meant to sort of is a self-help seminar, if you will, support group, you name it. It's certainly we can spend some time venting, hearing about your frustrations, but we hope that we can offer some encouragement and some ideas for maybe how to deal with recalcitrant government agencies, particularly the public affairs offices, who as often as not stand in your way of getting interviews and information as they do in helping you inform the public. I think we've all had those experiences. I had one just this past week.
Really?
And I was able to, in fact, help one reporter, one of our members, get an interview with an EPA scientist, score one, but it took him 4 days. And this is after the scientist had said she'd be happy to talk to him as soon as the Public Affairs Office authorized it. And then he spent 3.5 days trying to get a response from multiple public affairs offices before somehow we were able to cut through the fog and convince them that maybe this wasn't such a dangerous thing to let this guy talk to the scientist. But that's unfortunately sort of a rarity, and sometimes you just can't get it, and it might be your deadline doesn't work that way. So maybe what we're going to start to do here, we have a really good panel. It's a diverse panel. Folks who've volunteered to share their experiences with you. Our first panelist someone that's familiar to me as an old-timer. I'm an old-timer. I don't consider him necessarily one. But Ray Tyson is a co-founder of SEJ and a veteran environmental journalist. He's currently on the staff of Environmental Health News. After what he characterizes as a brief detour, that's all relative, of course, as a public affairs director at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. So I thought we might start with Ray to just sort of maybe paint the landscape for us a little bit about both sides of the fence, but especially that other side where we're often wondering why it is that we can't get through to the people that we want. Ray, you want to start us off? Tell us what's going on when we can't get our interviews.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. This is an old journalistic trick, which is I'm going to frame the problem and let somebody else solve it. Tim is right that I've had a long career in environmental journalism, was a co-founder of this organization. And then after 20 years on the beat, I decided it was time for a career change. And I had a number of intriguing possibilities, but the one that appealed to me the most was something that was a radical departure, which was to go to work for the federal government in highway and vehicle safety, which in my mind was about as far as I could get from environmental journalism. And this was during the latter stages of the Clinton administration. And I was offered assurances, because I didn't want to abandon my journalistic ethics, that I would be allowed to run a completely transparent press operation, giving journalists access to documents, to agency experts, and so on. And that's pretty much the way it went when I first went to work. The Clinton administration was good to its word. Reporters were given access to lawyers, engineers, scientists, were given access to documents. We worked with organizations like ABC 2020 on some interesting investigative projects. So everything was pretty much the way I had hoped. And then at the election, when President Bush was elected, the pattern continued. I was pretty encouraged because, you know, anytime there's a change in administration in Washington, you always run the fear that things are going to change. The first Bush administration was just as transparent as the second Clinton administration. The first notice I had that things might change a little came between the first and second Bush term. The White House got pretty upset with network television coverage of the election. So for the second Bush term, they imposed a restriction, which was that we were not allowed to grant network on-camera interviews without prior clearance from the White House. But otherwise, other than that one restriction, things didn't really change. You know, the transparency continued. The access was terrific. And I still, from a journalistic ethics standpoint, felt good about working in Washington for the federal government. And then things changed pretty dramatically. When Barack Obama was elected, it was very clear from the first day of that administration that they had a different view about press access to government. And that, to me, was pretty discouraging because, like a lot of idealistic people in Washington, we were real hopeful that the Obama administration would somehow be different. It was different, but not in a way that any of us could have imagined. The White House made it very clear right from the beginning that we were not allowed to be as open and free as we had been. They very definitely restricted our ability to work with journalists. They made it clear that if anyone was going to speak for the administration, that it would be a political appointee and not a career civil servant. And I want to just back up a little bit and talk to you, for those of you that aren't really totally aware of how things in Washington are structured. You know, government runs pretty much in the hands of career civil servants, but each administration has the opportunity to appoint individuals to key positions, and those positions include cabinet secretaries, agency administrators, chief counsel, sometimes public affairs directors, press secretaries, and so on. But again, they set the agenda for the administration, but the execution is in the hands of the career civil servants. But the Obama administration made it very clear that we were going to keep our mouths shut. And we were told that any request for an on-the-record interview had to be approved at the secretary's, by the secretary's staff. And then when we got into an economic program called Cash for Clunkers, which was an economic incentive to prop up the auto industry, the White House interference grew even more stringent. And in fact, as a public affairs director, I was required to have a daily telephone conference call with the White House because they wanted to monitor the progress of the program, and they wanted to very carefully control what was said about the success or failure of this program. We had a lot of requests, a lot of press interest. We had reporters asking for statistics, you know, which auto industries were benefiting from this program. We were told, if you get a request, tell the reporter to file a FOIA. We were not allowed to share any of that information. We were not allowed to make any of the people available who were running the program. In other words, it was a complete utter stonewall. And, you know, at a certain point, you know, I may have been at that point a second career civil servant, but from an ethical standpoint, I could not stand by and watch a government agency have that kind of an approach to transparency and access to government.
So this is coming from the administration that pledged at the outset of shortly after inauguration that it was going to be the most transparent in history.
Yeah, it began immediately. I mean, it wasn't a slow transformation. It was an immediate transformation. And as soon as Barack Obama was sworn in and they put their people in place, you know, it took a couple of weeks to appoint the cabinet secretaries and get them confirmed and get their staff in place. Once their staff was in place, the curtain went down.
Well, thanks, Ray. Many of us wonder sometimes if we're paranoid about... we may be paranoid, but they really are out to get us. Okay, thank you for setting that scene and helping us understand why it seems that things have gotten worse lately, because apparently they really have. Our next panelist is an author and a longtime freelancer, Lizzie Grossman. She's author of Chasing Molecules, High Tech Trash, and other books. And she's been published in the Scientific American, Environmental Health Perspectives, Yale E360, and many others. Lizzie, why don't you tell us how you managed to, outwit the Stonewall at times?
Thanks, and Ray, thank you very much for that. I couldn't resist noting down there's a quote in a William Burroughs novel that says paranoia is just an accurate assessment of the facts. I've had quite a variety of experience interacting with federal agencies because, as Tim mentioned, I've written a number of books. I also primarily write news features, and for the past couple of years, I've also been doing daily news briefs for kind of a news service called Chemical Watch. It's based in the UK, and they cover chemicals management policy. So I've both covered federal and state policy for them. And I just what I thought I'd do was share some anecdotes and offer a couple of workarounds that I've discovered, some successful, some not so successful. I've had a lot of dealings with the EPA, both in working on news features, doing book work, and also doing news briefs. Like all of us, most of my interactions have to go directly, start with the PIOs, and that has been no end of frustration. Weeks and weeks of going back and forth and waiting for people to get back to me. I think I actually have pretty cordial working relations with the people whose names we see on the media contacts. There's one PIO who I talked to so much that at one point he started venting to me about the system. I mean, I had him on the phone for quite a long time about his frustration, about having to clear things up the chain of command. He wasn't quite as explicit as Ray, but that was kind of the gist of what I got from him. At one point recently, I have gotten so frustrated with trying to get some really, I thought, pretty mundane information about a program that I'd been asked to look into by an editor, that I actually went on the SEJ website, found the name of the person that Tim and others at SEJ had been talking to about improving our relations, and I just persisted on the phone until I actually got her, and she said, oh gosh, I'm so sorry, let me see what I can do. And then all of a sudden, the PIO I'd been talking to on this particular task popped up and said, oh, let me see if I can arrange an interview. And I eventually got an interview with the two sort of principals at this program. And what did they do? They read me what I had already read on the website during our interview. And I never actually wrote anything from it. Also at EPA, I end up going to a lot of science conferences as part of what I do. And in the course of that, I have met a lot of EPA scientists, staff scientists, researchers, particularly in one program area that I've been writing about a lot. I've gotten to know them a little bit. I now have a couple of people I can call, I can email and call offline. I mean, they don't do anything regulatory. What they do really is not top secret. There is no reason they shouldn't be able to talk to the press about this, but they're not authorized to. but I've been able to, just by talking on the phone and agreeing not to use their names, continue to talk about them just so I can get this information. It's sort of useful, and I wouldn't sort of blow that trust and use their names just because I know that that would make life difficult for them. At one point in the past couple years, things got so bad about getting information from PIOs, and this was before SEJ had completely fully engaged in a conversation with EPA, that I just persisted, and I sort of went up, and I ended up talking to a supervisor at EPA, a really nice man named Larry Jackson, who's no longer in that position. And I was in D.C. for a meeting once, and he said, well, we could have coffee. And I didn't go meet him in his office. It was pouring rain, like 7:45 in the morning at a, you know, cafeteria-type coffee shop a few blocks from the EPA headquarters in the pouring rain, and he apologized profusely and told me this was one of several meetings exactly like this he'd had in the past month, and after that, nothing changed. Different agencies I've dealt with, OSHA, the Department of Labor, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. I've been writing a lot about occupational health in the past few years and ended up covering the BP Deepwater Horizon on disaster from that perspective. And they have a really badly understaffed public communications office. And at one point it had taken, oh, it was about 5 weeks into my request for an interview with official, not the secretary, assistant secretary, but somebody below him. And I was trying. And then all of a sudden I had a story out, and this guy pops up following me on Twitter. And so I thought, oh, my gosh, if someone follows you on Twitter, you can send them a message. So I sent him a little note. I said, thanks for following. Any closer to an interview? And he sent me an email from his personal Gmail account and told me how to get an interview. And what it was that they'd asked me for questions, so I'd sent in questions, and they had to get these, just as Ray was telling us, they had to get these questions cleared all the way up to, I guess, the White House. And he told me that if I could refer to something he had already said in print or in public, that would open up the floodgates. So he said, find anything. So I found some blog interview he'd given, and all of a sudden I had an interview. So you might think about that as a technique. Something else that I've done is try to figure out what other agency I can go to for something comparable. I've been doing a lot of writing about pesticides recently, those neonicotinoids that are harming pollinators, and just had no success whatsoever getting through to EPA. Absolutely none. They just kept sending me cut and pastes of the same thing that I had asked them my questions based on. And then I was poking around. USDA was perhaps even worse. They put me in touch with some woman who was argumentative, which has never happened to me before. And I was asking questions, and she said, are you suggesting we're not doing a good job? I said, no, I was just asking questions. But then I realized as I was poking around that USGS has been looking into a lot of similar science, and I've discovered this in a number of areas, that if you poke around, USGS does just phenomenally interesting research. They are not a regulatory agency. They don't get up. They're not very high profile. And I just picked up the phone, and I got the researcher. He answered the phone. He was great. And I asked him who else he was working with. Is there anybody else? And he said, oh, this is who you need to talk to. And I picked up the phone and called this other woman, and I had just really, really great information that was able to round out my story. So just wrap up by saying, you know, these problems are obviously legion. I don't actually blame the PIOs at this point. I mean, they seem to be stuck at the EPA. They seem to be stuck with this horrendous system. But the best workarounds I found is to find out if USGS or NOAA, where the scientists are also really free to talk, if you can find somebody besides EPA who's working on the science, try to go in that way. It doesn't help with the regulatory stuff. That's just, you know, really bad news.
Thanks, Lizzie. It's a good point that there are not all the federal agencies are the same. So you may find, happier hunting in some of the scientific agencies. NOAA is another one that at times can be very helpful.
And the only other thing I wanted to add is, if you have had an opportunity to meet somebody offline, they're just cultivate that relationship. Don't, you know, and I think kind of respect it, don't exploit it. I now have EPA, I've got a couple other agencies where I can talk to people, and as long as I keep it offline and just use it to inform my other questions, it seems to work pretty well, and it's not top secret stuff, so it's not a big deal.
Yeah. Yes, that's excellent. And one other recommendation I would make, because it occurs to me here, is when you have an actual opportunity to do face-to-face with these people, do it. You know, go to a public meeting. If they're appearing in your town, try to make a point of showing up and making contact so that they may remember you when you try to reach them before. I've found that has been helpful at times, even if they tell you later they can't talk to you without permission. But you would at least make some ability to actually get some response. The biggest problem sometimes we face is we send those requests off and then nothing, not even an acknowledgement, not a rejection, nothing. So you don't even know if they saw it. So that's one dimension of our challenge here. The sad truth is that this same system seems to be permeating itself down into state and even local government. I mean, I've been in this business long enough to remember when I used to be able to wander the halls of our State Department of the Environment and just pop into people's offices and shoot the breeze with them. No more. And even, you know, direct phone calls to them are as often as not shunted back to the public affairs office. And requests for interviews wind up with a email response, which is often not quotable. So it is a challenge even at that level, and many of us are dealing with that. One of our next panelists is somebody who's sort of working at that grassroots level as well as dealing with federal agencies at times. Camilla Mortensen, associate editor and reporter for Eugene Weekly, an alternative news weekly in Oregon, covers the environment from the coast of Oregon to the Cascade Mountains. And her beat includes covering activists and politics from county level all the way to the federal level. She's had sort of a different approach or entry point into journalism. Just goes to show that you don't need any special training to do it. Before becoming a journalist, she earned a master's degree in folklore and mythology. Probably comes in real handy in journalism. And a doctorate in comparative literature. Well read. So one of her last time she went to an SCJ conference, she wound up getting invited to embed with Earth First. And now knows more about activist and protest training than she could ever need. So, Camilla, tell us about your latest exploit.
So as you get sort of from that, I wind up doing a lot of activist reporting, and as it turns out, that has actually come in handy. I cover lots of different things, and from county to state, and county-wise, that one I'm in the middle of something in which it's actually gotten so ridiculous that the county commissioner that won't get back to me on my public records request has actually public records requested my emails with the other county commissioners and gotten them for free. And when I pointed that out in the paper, and that's the advantage of being an alt-weekly, I can snark them rather freely. I actually had a lawyer step up and said, this has actually gotten so ridiculous, I'm going to be your attorney for free. So that hopefully we'll see how that resolves. He called it low-hanging fruit. It turns out that there was one line in the way that they're setting up their public records request that says the money from the request that they're charging me is going to building maintenance, which is not legal. So we'll see how that one pans out. But the one I was going to talk about today is a lot of people know about sort of the oil train disaster that went on in Canada, and there was a lot of talk about oil trains going down the Columbia River, and I'm about 2 hours south of the Columbia River, so I didn't think oil trains were that much of an issue until someone sent me a picture of an oil train going through town and said, hey, there's crude oil going through town. So I said, great, call up the Oregon Department of Transportation, said I want to find out about oil trains. They said, no, we go to the fire marshal's office. So I called the fire marshal, and the PIO there was very helpful. And what he said basically was, one, I don't know why they sent you to me. I don't do oil trains. He said, it's only if it's stationary do I do it. But I'll tell you right now, they're not going to tell you anything. There's a post-9/11 statute in Oregon that says they don't have to tell you anything about hazardous materials on trains. He said, you should do a public records request, you should call the train company, and then you should go camp out by the railroad track and take pictures because that's the only way you're going to get anything. So I did a public records request, and in record time, the Attorney General's office got right back to me and said, no, absolutely no. You cannot find out how many trains, you cannot find out where they are, you cannot find out where they're going, you cannot find out how much they're carrying, you can't find if it's crude or anything else. So I said, can I please narrow my request? No. And then they went through the request methodically and showed me all the different things they could not possibly tell me. So I was thinking about this, and there is one of the activists that I've reported on actually had gotten in a rather large fight where he had been grand jury subpoenaed for one of his videos, and he had won the fight because the ACLU defended him and said that he's actually a videographer. And so I called him up. I'm like, you're a videographer. You're a journalist. Like, can you help me with? And he said, well, no, I can't right now, but the guy who does videos with me can, so call him. So I called up Micah, who as it turns out, a former freight hopper, and said, this is what I need. I need to get footage of trains. I need to prove, I just need to prove there's crude oil going through this town. And so he went out with his camera, and as it turns out, as a freight hopper, he knew all the train routes. He knew when they were going. He knew where they were going. He knew how to get to them to film them. And he and the other videographer, Tim, have a YouTube channel called Picture Eugene that they post things on. And actually, they've been quite successful. If you've seen the movie If a Tree Falls, a lot of the footage from If a Tree Falls is from videos that they shot over the years. And so he went out and began shooting the trains for me. And one of the things that the PIO had said was if the train has a diamond-shaped placard on it with four numbers, that will tell you what the train is carrying. If there's no placard, it's either not carrying any of the material. If there's a placard, it's either carrying it or it's carrying enough of it to be a danger that the fire marshal's office needs to know about that. So make sure you get video of those numbers. And as it turns out, there's an app for everything. So I soon discovered that there's actually an app for those numbers, and I double-checked it with the online database. And you type in, for example, 1267 for crude oil, if that's the number that goes by, and you punch that in there. And as soon as you punch it in, it tells you that's petroleum crude oil, and then it tells you everything you need to know about what it is that's on that particular train. So that was actually the story that I wound up doing, because I discovered a lot more than I would have through the public records request, that not only are there lots and lots of trains of crude oil going through, but there's also trains of things that a lot of you guys probably knew about that I didn't, that there was ammonia, there was chlorine gas. And actually, if you want to just hit play on that for like a minute, we won't show the whole thing. I think if you hit the space bar, it'll wake back up. He wound up getting footage for me of... trains of petroleum, gas, I'm sorry, of, if I can remember my password, talk at the same time, propane going through celebrations, of ammonia going through the shopping areas. This is his website. I won't play the whole thing, but this is the video he wound up putting together for me. That's the local celebration. Documenting all the trains that were going through. As a freight hopper, he was totally down with getting right there on top of the train. I was like, not going with you.
He's actually climbing on the train.
I didn't know that was going to happen.
Your mother always tells you not to play around things.
So anyway, I won't show the whole video, but he's sort of explaining the UN number card there. And goes through, gets all, these are the oil trains going through town. And he's much more adventurous than I am, and so he was running down the track scooping. He's like, look, it's dripping from the train. I'm like, don't, no touchies. No, that's, if we don't know what it is, we perhaps should not be scooping it up. But that was anyway, that was my workaround for when they wouldn't tell me what it is that they had on the trains. It turns out if you can find an anarchist with a camera, you can find out what's on the trains.
Did you get harassed by train railroad security guards or anything? Police?
There was a moment where we had to move a little quicker. however, he also, as a freight hopper, is very familiar with the pattern of what they call the bulls. And so he knew when and where they were going to be coming through. And apparently there's only one security for most of the corridor from Portland down to Eugene. So he was just very careful to take us out there when...
Great. How do I turn it off?
Hit space bar again should stop it.
There we go.
Oh, nice.
Oh, my favorite.
Yeah,
Diane. That's the bull call.
Yeah.
Yep. That's the good stuff. Oh, there we go. That's good. Okay, no.
That's a nice, yeah. Right there. That's good.
Hot.
That's good.
All right. Speaking of hot.
UN number.
UN number. So that's one way to deal with transportation. I was telling Camilla we had a little train mishap in Baltimore again this past year where a train carrying hazardous materials plowed into a truck crossing at an unmarked crossing and derailed, and there was an explosion and a fire, and we got information from the authorities, supposedly from the fire chief, about what was on the train. The only problem was that his own people had miscommunicated the names of the chemicals to him, and he relayed them to the media. Now, our on-scene reporter sent the data to the newsroom, and I grabbed it and started checking the chemicals to see what they were and to see what the consequences of having them burn, you know, be released or mix would be. And it quickly became apparent that two of the chemical names did not exist. They had garbled the names. It's totally understandable. There are multiple chemicals that sound very much alike, and these were non-technical people. These are firemen, you know, and rescue workers. But it took hours to get them to sort out what the real chemical names were. We didn't put them on, post them, because I said I will not, you know, relay stupid information or non-information. Some of the TV stations were not so careful. They simply posted it, thinking if it came from government, it must be true. So it's very helpful to have that kind of information, the numbers. So not that I want to pick on the broadcast media all the time, but they have a big challenge in terms of needing immediacy and needing actual footage and sound. And our next panelist can sort of address some of those issues. Karen Schaefer, freelance journalist, independent radio producer based in Northeast Ohio. She's worked in two Ohio public radio newsrooms and won scads of awards for her work, more than half for covering environmental issues. Karen, tell us what the particular challenges of a broadcaster are in dealing with this and getting access and how you've dealt with it.
Well, you can imagine getting an email from a public information officer at a federal or a local agency that says, well, we can get you that information. You want an interview? Oh, I'm sorry, we can't do that. Isn't terribly helpful when you want radio. You can't broadcast an email. You need a human voice. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had to explain this to PIOs. You would think they would get it. I mean, TV, they have to have a face, right? They have to have a human being. They have to have a face-to-face interview. In radio, often, sometimes a phone interview will do, but even that can be difficult to get. Here's what happened to me this year. I got a grant to do a series of six water quality reports for radio that I was going to be offering for free to a variety of radio stations in Ohio and Michigan and beyond. And they were topical, but none of them, with one exception perhaps, was particularly controversial. They were more sort of informational journalism. So I figured, I've been around in Ohio for a long time. I know everybody. I have been cleared all the way to Washington, D.C. a number of occasions with the U.S. EPA. I'd been, when I was working at one of the public radio stations, offered. I mean, you know, somebody calls me up out of the clear blue. Hey, U.S. EPA administrator is going to be in town. Do you want a one-on-one? So I figure, you know, I've got access. No problem. Wrong. And the access, or the lack of access, the stonewalling came in some really odd places, and I want to share with you where they happened and what I did about it. First of all, the one story that was slightly controversial had to do with the amount of water that's being used for fracking operations in the state of Ohio. Nobody had done that story. There were lots of other issues that were more important, but I figured, you know, let's throw this one in the mix, because that's what I was doing, trying to cover things that other people, other stations weren't already covering. Usually, it's really hard to get in touch with our State Department of Natural Resources, but to my astonishment, they set up an interview. To get the interview, however, I had to travel to Columbus, Ohio, 2 hours away. But, hey, okay. So I traveled to Columbus, I talked to not one but two officials, and then I went home. 5 hours for 45 minutes worth of tape. Oh, well, whatever. I was good with that because I had a story nobody else had. But then I came to what I thought was a really, you know, kind of a success story, but one which showed what it is that the federal government has been trying to do with the funding that they've been granting to the Great Lakes region. We have all these toxic rivers in the Great Lakes, and in Ohio we have four of them. And I had learned through a local state EPA person that one of the rivers was nearing finishing all of the things that they needed to do to get the river off the federal list of toxic rivers. And I said, huh. And it was a river way out in kind of pretty country, no major cities, and I figured, you know, nobody had really been covering this, and nobody else would be writing this story, and I could go on site. And so anyway, I talked to my state agency, a PIO, somebody I know so well that his number is like my speed dial, right? And he didn't think there would be any problem whatsoever. And another woman who was actually in sort of head of the Lake Erie program this year, the previous year, had said, oh, you should do this story, but we'll get you, no problem. Well, his chief, the PIO's chief, had another idea. And I'll back up and point out that in Ohio, at our last election, we inherited an ultra-conservative governor, a gentleman by the name of John Kasich, whose first action in office was to turn down the federal money to build a high-speed rail system in the state. So I wanted to tell the story of this river cleanup, but I needed to be on site. And there was a guy who was going to be going out doing some testing, electrofishing, of this new set of fish shelves, kind of broad underwater platforms that would create better habitat in the river, to see if it was really working. They'd been up for a year or two. And I was told I could go along. And then as I'm at another site doing another story in this series and gathering some interviews, the PIO comes up to me and he says, I'm sorry, we have some bad news. We're not going to be able to get you on the site. We're not going to be able to give you, because in radio, I not only need human voices, I need sound. I need to hear. We need to get out there with the scientists. We need to hear what they're doing. We need to, you know, set the scene. I need the sound of waves slapping a boat. I need, you know, I need the sound of the equipment. Yeah.
1 minute.
Okay. So he plays me. He actually plays me the entire 2.5-minute explanation of why it is I can't get the interview. But I think it came down to an administration that's decided not to spend money or whatever on getting journalists access to what's going on, even good news stories. So, to make a long story short, I went up the chain of command. I called the U.S. EPA, which also has a hand in this project. I got a phone interview with their regional chief, whom I knew because he'd been a previous Ohio EPA director. That was good, but that didn't get me on site. So I called the U.S. EPA guy who was in charge of the site project. Who can I talk to locally? He gave me a name or two. I got on to that guy, who was a local guy, turned out really great. Then I got an Ohio Sea Grant person. That's an agency of, we do have inland seas, the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. That's an agency of NOAA. As you point out, NOAA is a little more accessible than a lot of things. And I wound up going on the site with not one, not two, but three people, none of them from the agencies. And then I drove back down to Columbus to get that one Ohio EPA statement I needed. All that work, that was just one of six stories. It was crazy.
Persistence pays off, but you really need to have time to do that. And sometimes we don't always have that time. You know, this issue also translates into problems at the local level. I mean, you actually find that your municipal government sometimes is just about as rigid about giving out information and interviews as anybody else. And our last panelist here is somebody that's sort of to complete the circle, who has also, not unlike our first panelist, Ray, spent at least a little time as a public affairs officer. John Messeter is calls himself a hiker, a conservationist, and he's an award-winning multimedia journalist who's mainly written about the outdoors, collisions between water and the needs of, as he calls them, his fellow electricity addicts, and sometimes about spiders. He's written for papers in Alaska, Maine, and Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. He's written for the Chesapeake Bay News Service and assorted others. And he says here that he actually served a brief stint as a U.S. Navy public affairs officer. John, tell us about what you do with the with some of the local folks that you've run into.
Well, one of the things I've discovered, because I have worked mostly small market newspapers, is that this kind of thing permeates virtually all levels. And sometimes in some places you can cultivate somebody, you can meet them. I really believe a lot in going to events and meeting somebody face to face. You a lot of times get better answers than you do. And technology of late has really made it easy to call up a PAO and get an answering machine that says, if you leave your deadline and a detailed message what you want, and often those people don't really know what the information is going to be anyway, so they really do need to look it up. You go to a fire department, and this is worse in Pennsylvania in my experience than any other place I've been, but I've met it other places to varying degrees. You go to a fire department and the house is burning, and you ask, is the house burning? And somebody says, go talk to the chief. Yeah. it's like, and that's not all that much of an exaggeration. So, and it works up from there to go to various departments. I had a good contact in labor and industry in Pennsylvania, and that helped out a whole lot. And one of the things I learned out of that was a sign that I put up over my desk, you didn't ask. As you're asking questions, they're only going to ask or not answer exactly what you ask. So you oftentimes end up hanging up the phone and say, but, you know, what I really wanted to know was, and the answer is, you didn't ask. So that's part of the thing. As a PAO in the Navy for a couple of years, I got a real good education out of that about the job of the public affairs person is to make the boss, A, look good, or B, not look bad. That's what they're hired for. That's their whole purpose in life and as the current Obama administration has made amazingly clear, the job of the PAO is not to feed information that you can't figure out some way to get. And what I've found is, it's those questions that you ask. It's the personal contacts that you make. It's finding other sources. So when we have my most recent piece about XTO, a driller that spilled 57,000 gallons of used fracking fluid on the ground, and the EPA report, when it finally came out 2.5 years later, 2010, they found the problem. And in July of 2013, they finally announced a settlement. And one of the things it said was, in a tributary, they found some of this in a tributary of the Susquehanna River. That, to me, is somebody just dumped 60,000 gallons of poison in the Susquehanna River. We could get into a lot more stuff about that. But what I ended up with one DEP person who gave me a statement. And the statement said next to nothing. We're going to continue to monitor and investigate and establish a significant fine. And I went back and said, could you give me some idea what a significant fine is? Because the EPA had a $100,000 civil penalty on the second largest profit-making petro producer in the world, at least by some numbers I've read. But I did get another one who gave me a whole different answer about another stream and mining that really went into the story a little bit, and that was there are so many sources from the old mining in Pennsylvania that we can't solve them. We haven't figured out how to stop this stuff. And that actually became kind of, to me, a key piece of where I was going with this. Why is this so important about 57,000 gallons of what the Susquehanna River Basin said we haven't detected? And, of course, the company jumps right on that. And so I guess what I'm saying here is you need to go try to find other sources, but in a lot of ways what we're doing is police work. And you get a little hint here, and you get a little hint over there, and eventually you get enough to make a picture.
Thank you, John. That's good opening from everybody. Does anybody want on the panel first, before we throw it to the audience, want to sort of respond to what anybody else?
Yeah, I would like to embellish on John's response, because I think that there is another crucial element to the public affairs officer's responsibilities. You know, when I was working for the government, probably 60 to 70% of the inquiries we got from reporters were journalists who did not normally cover the beat. Mm. So if you're dealing with a beat reporter like Matt Wald, the New York Times, and some of the others, they obviously know the issues as well as you do. But oftentimes, the inquiry you got was from a journalist who didn't cover the agency regularly. So to me, the public affairs officer's responsibility was to help background that journalist into the issue that they were trying to cover. And I think a good public affairs officer can be very adept at that and can be a valuable tool for reporters who are pushed into a story but don't necessarily have the background they need in order to do an intelligent job.
Okay, thanks. Anyone else here?
The only other thing, we've been talking entirely about public agencies, but the only other thing I'd want to throw in the mix is the other realm of the world that I have to call a lot is corporate America. And I would be absolutely fascinated to maybe, Camilla, you've got an earth firster of corporate America who we can embed with and find out what their training is so that the public affairs officers never answer the phone. You have to email them. And it's just this labyrinthine exercise in persistence, and it's only by making multiple calls that I can ever get through. And I don't know if, as part of the back and forth, it would be interesting to throw that into the mix, because obviously they're not dealing with regulations and government policy, but it's a whole other realm that, to me, is no end of frustration, because it's at least as bad.
I think we could have a whole different session on how to get information out of private entities.
Yeah.
And there actually is some interaction, because there's a lot of information those corporations have to supply to the government that you could use to gather your information.
Yeah.
But let's open it up to questions. First one right here. Please identify yourself and ask a question.
Hi, my name is Rhoda Covell. I work for the Chesapeake Bay Journal. I'm based in Baltimore. And I guess I was wondering, talk about getting around, like exposing this thing through the app and completely working around the FOIA thing. Do we think that we're getting to an era where the whole business of asking the government for information is out of date? Because we have people, like in Pennsylvania, we have a group called, I guess they're not just in Pennsylvania, called the Frack Tracker. And for Marcellus Shale drilling and just drilling in other places, they get information from the state that's like raw data, which I wouldn't really know what to do with. And they analyze it, and they put out information. And then you have your activists, you know, getting pictures and putting in apps and figuring out what it is. And I'm just wondering if at some point, very soon, are they going to become completely useless to us?
I don't know that they'll be useless. I mean, you still
Karen,
have...
Karen, could you just sort of, summarize
right.
the...
Right. I think the question is, given that we have, as Kamala did, lots of workarounds now, especially getting in touch with activist groups and others, that maybe government officials are not a good source of information. I think that we still probably need to make the effort. When you work with an editor, he's going to say, okay, well, what did the government say? And it's part of the balance of a story. Whether or not they are the best source of information or will, in fact, not talk to you at all, needs to be part of the story sometimes. You know, you need to be able to say, as I just did this myself. I had in another story, I talked with an EPA official at a conference. She talked to us then, and I tried to get back in touch with her and talk to her some more, and I was told that she's not available for whatever reason. And so that's going to be my story, you know. So I think we need to keep fighting back because we do need to know what the government stance is. We need to be able to expose the fact that they're not telling us what it is that we need to know, what the public needs to know. So.
I was going to add to that. And also everyone's dealing with the shrinking newsrooms that even if you can get information, sometimes having the staff to sort through all this wonderful information takes forever. And you'll notice that I'm prone to teaming up with activists. There's a local watchdog group that monitors the pesticide toxics whenever testing the stormwater runoff into the rivers. And so he actually goes through all that data, compiles it, tells me who's polluting, and then we run every week just a brief column saying this is who's been given a fine this week. And then there's another person who collates all the aerial sprays that are going around in the mountains, and they send that to us. And so we have the spray schedule. We run that every week. And so that actually cuts me a little bit of time, and then I can go through and be like, let's see who's polluting according to the thing that we're going to run. And if I can't get to it, at least I'm getting the information mm-hmm. out there.
Isn't that prompt them since you're already doing what they won't do for you? Does that then prompt them to be helpful, or do they just ignore it?
Yeah, my experience with that is that all that data that's on the internet and the email information that you sometimes get is helpful to help you formulate questions to talk to real people. And that goes, yeah, I gotta say, I've been doing this reporting gig for about 30 some years in a variety of places that he's already been listed. And one of the things that in a way like radio, even print, you got to go talk to people. You can get off the internet, and a local TV station often gets off a scanner that there's a fire someplace. But if you really want to see what's going on, and if you want to detect that there's some hazardous stuff out in the backyard that the fire company's really worried about, you got to go to the scene. And that amounts to the same thing talking with these people in the PAO offices. You got to know your questions and what that data that's online, they increasingly seem to hide behind the online.
Yes.
To me, mm-hmm. they say, oh, that's, you can get that here. Well, okay, thank you for the pointer. And you go there and you look, and then you end up going back with another question. Sometimes you get an answer, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you got to beat their brains out in order to get a little something. But sometimes when you're talking to somebody, what they don't say is almost as good as what they do say, as far as what you're trying to learn what's going on. So, no, I don't think there's that data. If we think that the data that is online that is so available because it really doesn't take much to scan a document and put it up there and then tell every reporter that calls up, it's over, here's the URL. I think if we get caught behind that trap, we're going to just aid the people who are trying to protect their image.
Yeah, and I was just going to add that I rarely go to a government agency to ask them for information. I've already done the research. I've looked at the EPA docket. I've gone through all of the reports. I've looked at the reams of stuff that I need to look at. And then I'm asking them for a very specific response or a question that I have based on that information. I see that there are, I mean, umpty-ump scientific studies that EPA considered that showed that these pesticides are harmful to pollinators. You know, what can you explain what was going on here, whatever my question was. But I don't usually go to them to ask for that information. And the real frustration is that I will have looked at this stuff. I have my question based on the data, and what they send me back is usually like the link to the place where I could already find the thing that I found. So, I mean, the background stuff, you know, occasionally that's really helpful. But so I don't think they may be irrelevant for getting to that primary source information because it's accessible through other channels, but not for the response. And that's where it's really frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the points that comes out of this is that you should do whatever background by looking at their websites first. Admittedly, some of the government agencies, their websites are far from transparent. Mm-hmm. So there's stuff buried deep in there sometimes that may be relevant that you can't find on first. But you're going to save yourself a little bit of frustration if you've already been there, because then when they say go look at the website, you can point out that you've already done that and you have the information. So you'll get then to the point where they'll say, well, we can't help you. But let's see. You had your hand up next.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
go ahead. Identify yourself, please, young man.
I'm Davis. I'm with the FCJ Watchdog Project, and so is Tim, actually. And so there's an FCJ component of this equation, and it's sort of the premise of this session, strategies for the stonewalled, is, well, no, it's actually not that helpful a lot of the time to ask for information for the government. And Lizzie's totally right. You got to do the reporting. But there's one component of it is for SEJ to keep putting lit matches under the toes of the government. And because the job of a lot of the PIO agency, the Agency Public Affairs Office, is really not to prevent oil spills or chemical disasters. It's to prevent PR disasters. Mm-hmm. And the way they can do that is by just keeping all the valves shut tight. And so part of our job is to make it be bad PR and bad public affairs and for them to behave this way. So SEJ in its various ways has tried to light a fire under the EPA public affairs apparatus, and we're going to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And Tim might. But, you know, so we have a new chance with Gina McCarthy. But you gave a really important insight, Ray, that, I mean, I've known all along, it comes down from the White House. And that's where we need to point the finger, too. We send letters to EPA, and when they get back to us a year later, they're really apologetic for not getting back to us. But when we send letters to the White House, they don't even answer.
Let me tell you a quick story.
So the question is, who is it who's blocking all that access?
Let me tell you a quick story that may be a little revealing. When Obama was elected, I was in a small town, actually where I live, before I went off to do my overnight coverage, and I was hanging out at the polling station, and he had this incredible on-the-ground, you know, network, as you know, and, you know, lawyers and everything. I mean, it was amazing. And I'd already identified them all and talked to them a little bit, you know, how was it going? And long before the polls closed, they were packing up their cell phones and stealing away. And I said, you guys are going? And he said, yeah, we've won. What? The rest of the nation didn't know that. And it was like, what? So they were so prepared, so controlling of just even the election information. They had the numbers. If that tells you anything about the control, I saw it even before he was elected. I would go to a meeting, and, you know, there'd be the traveling press, and they'd have tables set up for broadcast, but the local press weren't supposed to use them, and I had to fight with them to be able to sit there. Otherwise, I'd have to stand, you know, during an entire event. I think, whether it's Obama or his administration, I think it's his mentality, though. I think it started even before, you know, he came into office.
Let's see, we had a question back here.
Oh, for those are actually.
Kamala, repeat the question.
Sorry, just want to know how we vet the information that comes through. For those particular columns, they're actually running as separate columns, so not under. It's not something I'm doing into my story. If I then draw upon that for a story, I then go back to the documents, get the documents from them. They make it so difficult to get, for example, just the aerial spray schedule, that the only way to get them is to be signed up for this list that costs X amount of money. And the schedule is scheduled. They tell you it's going to happen within a 6-month period. They don't tell you exactly when it's going to happen. So we pretty much just print this that this is what the agency is putting out there, and if I'm actually going to use it for a story, then I have to go back through all those things and then try to talk to people, which then gets the same thing everyone else is saying, gets really crazy trying to get someone to... Yes. Yeah. And it's like this is coming from these people. Here's their contact information. And it's under a separate, it's a sort of a, I don't know if you'd call it a courtesy column. It's a sort of, here's the alert schedule for this. And it's under their name. It's under their contact information. And sort of like, as it's sort of like an editorial column, it's very clear it's coming from that particular group.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Question?
I have a comment.
Identify yourself.
Sorry.
Please.
And he called me back to correct me. I didn't get a radio interview, but I had him on the phone, and I at least got him to answer some other questions while I had him on the phone. So I don't know if that was...
Yeah.
That occasionally works.
Right.
Sometimes.
Right. Yeah. There you go. All right.
Tim, I'd like to go back to something that Joe said about where this is all coming from. I never saw in my tenure, the 2-year period I served the Obama administration, I never saw any evidence that it was the president or the vice president. But it was coming from people below. And the interesting thing is that through history, I think that political appointees and elected officials have always had a minor distrust of career civil servants because they're worried that the career civil servant will have an agenda that might be critical of the current administration. This administration, I got the impression that they felt that they could control the message better by not saying anything to reporters and simply getting the message out on their own terms. And I'll tell you the extreme it went to. The Department of Transportation, where I worked, the secretary appointed by the president was a former Illinois congressman by the name of Ray LaHood, who came into the job with no transportation experience. The White House determined, however, that Ray LaHood would be the voice of the administration on any issues related to transportation. And I'll tell you how absurd it got. The agency I work for had a politically appointed administrator by the name of David Strickland. And when we got interview requests, we were not allowed to offer David Strickland, who was a political appointee, confirmed by Congress, the interviews had to go to Secretary LaHood. The only time Strickland got to speak is when he got summoned to testify before a House or Senate committee. So that's the extent to which they wanted to control the message. It was not just political appointees who were allowed to talk to reporters. It was the secretary himself.
Thanks, Ray. That's a good, you know, you remind me of another workaround in terms of dealing with federal officials anyway. When you can't get at the federal official that you want to interview, oftentimes, especially in this administration, they've been dragged up to Capitol Hill to testify and answer questions. And you may find buried in a committee hearing, transcript. Often there are webcasts that are saved, or at least in a transcript, the answers and comments that you can use, quotes that you can use when you can't get a direct person.
And during any of the breaks, they may often go outside of the committee room where you can ambush them. Not ambush, you can...
That's okay. Buttonhole, right?
You can buttonhole and greet them with a live tape recorder.
And the other thing, I mean, this is not very dramatic or glamorous, but the other workaround is go to the regional offices. And I was recently doing a story of something about lead, and I couldn't get anybody at EPA. The CDC people wouldn't talk to me because it's all gotten politicized because the budget's been completely decimated on that program. And so I just started calling. I just went on to the, you know, the map of the EPA, and I just started calling, and I finally got somebody who answered the phone. It's really time-consuming. It's really annoying. But I finally got somebody who talked to me. So forget about headquarters in D.C. and just kind of fan out, and eventually you usually end up with somebody who will, you know, respond. So
over here, young lady. Yes. Your name, please.
Carolyn Lester.
There you go.
You knew that.
One of the SEJ people involved in this battle with EPA for a couple of years, I want to sort of echo what Ray said. I think it became really evident to me that it was a political issue that was blocking access to any of these people at EPA. And I'm not even sure the letters we wrote actually went that Lisa Jackson ever saw any of these letters. And so it's a very frustrating, you know, frustrating exercise in trying to, find out what's going on and how to work around it. And it seemed like just as soon as we were making traction, we'd get a new appointee in to, and you have to start all over. But I also want to comment on the corporate issue. Call corporate a lot in my job, and I find that increasingly frustrating because it's the same canned statement that they're sending everywhere. And a lot of websites, you don't even have a name of the person.
Right.
Some you have to register in order for them to even acknowledge it. It's crazy. But one way I've been working around that is I'll call an industry group.
Yeah.
And I'll call an industry group and say, hey, look, I really want to get a comment from this company on this. Any way that you can get me the name of somebody to call. And that has been sometimes helpful, not always, and especially on deadline, it's not always an easy trick, but on, you know, on a longer term period, you know, I've been able to access people.
And my other trick on that, on the people who don't have any names, is just pull up the press releases. And it's not always true, but very often there is a name, even if they've hired an outside firm. And at one point, I can't even remember the company. It was supposed to, I think it was something like Timberland, which I was told to talk to because they had some really innovative, new, environmentally friendly products. So this was going to be like a good story for them, not even, you know, nothing nasty. And they had no contacts, and I, you know, went through all these press releases, and finally somebody answered this phone, and she was at an outside firm, and she said, why are all these people calling me? And she actually was helpful, but she had no idea that there was no other way in. But the press release is a good thing. Yeah.
I'll find names in the press releases.
Yeah, but anyway.
I think part of that goes back to looking up the research, doing the research and knowing some people. One of the things I've figured out over the years is that a lot of times the guy at the top really doesn't know the nuts and bolts of what's going on underneath, and I don't care whether that's the CEO of the company and you're having problems with customer service at your local Sears, or whether is this Obama's fault? He's obviously got the responsibility for setting a tone, but there's a lot of people underneath him that interpret that whatever way they think is right, and so I'm not sticking up for him. But I think that doing the homework ahead of time and finding some other contacts, like I get into DEP on some water issues because I happen to live near somebody who I can talk to, and I can't quote him because you don't quote somebody who's not from the public affairs office. And if you call up a scientist or, you know, somebody who really has the subject matter expertise, And as soon as you say your press, they refer you right over to, well, let me connect you with Lisa. And Lisa's not there, and it turns out she's the press secretary. But you do get a lot of information talking to the guy that you can't quote that helps you formulate your questions when you get where you're going. Because back to that part about you didn't ask, it doesn't always work. I'm not saying it's a panacea, but it doesn't always work. But back to the part about you didn't ask is if you don't know, you're in the position of the person who's never had this beat before that Ray was talking about, and they don't answer questions that you don't know enough to ask about.
Yep,
a lot of them.
That's true. Question here. Identify yourself, please.
My name is Bill Brown. I'm from Resort College. My question is based on that. You get all this information from all the sources you can't quote, you can't mention, you're off record. And when you're trying to get an official source and they won't say anything that you can actually use, how can you use all this information? How can you report all this information without losing some credibility of the report itself? Write that or
if you've talked to several people and read several emails and you don't have anything that you can, particularly that you can hang on a particular name, and that happens increasingly. I got a note from the EPA guy that said, right off first line, you can't, if you quote any of this, you got to quote EPA. You can't quote an individual person. And that goes a little bit against the journal. But I find that if you get enough material, you can put it together to draw a picture. And I think, and this is just, some other people may have some other approaches to this or views on it. It becomes not quite so important that you name the particular public official, because all they're doing is telling you what they're supposed to be telling you anyway. So, but if the EPA says, or if DEP says, or if a DEP spokesman who you weren't supposed to use their name, and it, rather than burn them by use their name, just put out that DEP has done this and this is the information we got from them. And sometimes you can say that it came from the communications office without identifying where it exactly came from. And I will throw one piece in on this and just make a short piece, but I got into a conversation with a guy who used to be public affairs for labor and industry. And one of the things he said was that quite often somebody in a position to tell you something doesn't want to be quoted because they don't want other people knowing that they told you that and didn't tell it in general. Because there are folks out there that will go, geez, that's public information. How come all the papers didn't get it? Well, because you knew the person, you knew where to get it, and you got it, and that's how you got your scoop or your exclusive. But he doesn't want to get in trouble for not talking to everybody.
And I just have one thing I want to add into the SEJ general conversation on these issues, and I know we're about to wrap up. And what made me think of it is I just got an AP breaking news note that says President Obama speaks exclusively to the AP in a wide-ranging interview. Something I'd love for SEJ to take up is the issue of access depending on outlet. I'm a freelancer. Yeah. I write for a lot of different outlets. If I call up and say I'm writing for the Washington Post or Scientific American, Environmental Health Perspectives, I get one response. If I'm on a press call and I say I'm from the Pump Handle or writing for Earth Island Journal, you can be sure they will never answer my question. They'll take three questions from the guy from Time and none from me. And I would love, with the fact that the environmental be increasingly being covered by freelancers, I mean, if it's a good public information officer, they know, you know, the people at EPA know me. They know I'm not going to do some weird, gotcha, uninformed thing at this point. But that's not always the case. And we have lots of newcomers, and I would love to throw that into the mix so that we don't have this weird pecking order where that continues to happen.
Briefly.
The whole setup of insider exclusive journalism is the enemy of freedom of information journalism. And therefore, it is incumbent on SEJ not to let the Associated Press dominate and issue orders to its FOI apparatus and lip speech.
Okay.
And to... quick, very quick points, 1 minute. Don't forget, if you can't get through to a government official, think about a retiree from that same agency.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, don't forget professors. You know, you can often a law professor will have studied the same issue and will not only be able to give you some of the information you were looking for, but be able to critique it.
Mm-hmm. That's it. Good. Did you want to say something, young man?
Sure. John Wilkie from the Post-Gazette in Pittsburgh. My question kind of goes off of the recent comments here, but this whole panel has looked at informational bottlenecks from government agencies and corporations, et cetera. And I'm just wondering, given the diversity of media outlets we represented up here, what filters, what bottlenecks are there on the other end, that is, from various media outlets, mainstream press versus newer media models? Are you able to get more information in there, and are you at an advantage because you don't have three layers of editors like I have or other mainstream press has? Is it easier for you to get that information without that filter, or do you have that same filter?
Are you talking about getting information or putting it out?
Putting it out.
Okay, so the question is are you able to put out more information if you're...
Really quick response on that, because one of the places I write for is the pump handle. I write fully reported, fully edited, hyperlinked to my footnotes from Here to Kingdom Come pieces. But because of that medium, it's a fluid medium, it does not operate under the same strictures that Scientific American does or environmental health perspectives, I can cover a story in progress. I can say, this is what we know at this point, here are the documents, and I can come back to it. And I love that. Yeah, I love it. And I have been able to cover these environmental health, occupational health, breaking, developing situations in a way that I cannot in a crystallized feature. So I'll just throw that out there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to have... Oh, one. This is the last question. Please identify yourself.
I'm Janice Smith, and I'm from the University of Oklahoma.
Okay.
And one of the things I wanted to say about the being from a public university, we have a lot of state and federal groups located on our campus that I work with on a daily basis, and I actually field reporters' questions all the time, and we are very open to and try to answer every request we get, and some of them I forward on to the person on our campus, and they do it, they take care of it if I ask them to. And the USGS has climate science centers all over the country that you can contact. Mm-hmm. We have, ours on our campus, I actually do their press relations.
Yeah.
And even though they're a UI facility, we have OU professors working with them. So,
generally quite helpful, yes, and in finding those experts who often served in government or who have worked closely with them so they can interpret and provide information and pointers. Well, we're going to wrap up here. I just want to make one appeal as the chair of the SEJ Freedom of Information Task Force. We have I've been doing this, I guess, a little less than a year now, and have gotten reintroduced to the Hall of Mirrors in trying to deal with the current crowd in Washington. Have been there for an in-person meeting with the group that started off the interview to talk about improving access and share our concerns, and was greeted by the Associate Administrator for Community Affairs and Public Affairs at EPA after having this set up, and his response as soon as he sat down with me and welcomed me in was to say he's leaving. So it was a very helpful meeting because everything that we talked about in 2 weeks was totally gone, and a whole new crowd was in there. We nonetheless have continued to press the case, and we will continue to press the case. One of the things that we are trying to do is to compile a record. All right, we have gone public in the last year with our statements and belief that there's an information bottleneck, stonewalling going on, and that this administration is in some respects one of the least open that we've dealt with in recent memory, at least. We want to continue to document that. They have insisted that they are open, that that these are problems that they will deal with one at a time. So what we want to do is compile a record one at a time. If you have a good experience with a government official, let us know. If you have a bad experience with a government official, let us know. If you are running out of ideas on how to get the information you need, reach out to us. Call me. Like the fellow that did this past week. I picked up the list and saw where he had been trying to get information for 2-3 days, and I urged him to contact up the chain of command, just like the recommendation here. He did. I even urged him to quote Gina McCarthy, speaking at the press club 2 weeks ago, saying, when asked by a question that Dr. Davis planted, what about interviewing EPA scientists? Now that you're administrator, are you going to allow us to interview EPA scientists? And she said, well, we always allow that. But if you have a problem, we'll talk. So he sent all that up, nothing. And he, you know, I reached out and I called, and I did luck out and get this person that he had finally appealed to at the top, the head of the media office, and said, can you... You know, this is ridiculous. He admitted it was ridiculous. He made a call. 24 hours later, the reporter got the 5-minute interview he had been seeking for 4 days. So sometimes we can help. At the very least, we can compile a record, and we can put it out there and put the public spotlight on this issue so that the public can know how they're not being served by their own government. Yes. Yes, indeed. So,
if I could stick in just a little brief piece about 9/11, this has gotten worse, and there's a whole industry over protecting stuff. The thing about the trains, I dealt with a local guy who said it's easier to just put a block on all of this stuff about ammonia, and we got a lot of that stuff handled around where we live. Well, shouldn't people know? Well, you got to keep that from the terrorists. That has become a really big excuse for not putting out information. I think that's going to do nothing but get worse.
It's all there. Well, thank you all for coming. If you have any other questions, you can talk to the panelists here.